Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, maintaining an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business, in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Reston, Virginia, and Greater Boston. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
John, you and I are operating this podcast under the power and the authority of America's Constitutional First Amendment.
Yeah.
Thank you, First Amendment. Why did they forget to put it in the Constitution in the first place? That's what I want to know. Because the freedom of speech is something that people live and die for, and it's a remarkable thing. However,
there's still a lot of nations that don't have that freedom of speech.
So yeah, that's true.
We're lucky.
But, you know, the interesting thing about the First Amendment is try to really figure it out.
Yeah,
it certainly isn't unbridled. I mean, it doesn't mean you can yell fire in a crowded theater, correct, John? So it is not necessarily that all-encompassing thing.
No.
In fact,
isn't it just the government?
Yes.
Yes.
John, you remember that from some of the other speakers.
From other podcasts.
Yeah, well, it's true. It's not about your company. If you go to your boss and your boss says, look, this is the way it's going to be done in this company, and you really give him or her a bit of lip, they can say, you're out of here. You say, wait a minute.
I got free speech.
Yeah, you just abridged my First Amendment. Yeah, well, that's a bridge too far over here. Get the heck out of here. I mean, the truth is, it is as it relates to the government. But it also is a little bit, well, needs a little bit more interpretation than I think a lot of people give it in terms of what does it really mean? What does it really protect? Now, let's go to the campuses, John.
Okay.
Because I know we've talked about this in the past on a couple of different podcasts. Now, Stanley Fish, who's our guest today, who's written a book called The First. And I'll tell you what the subtitle is later because it's fascinating. But he was invited to speak at Seton Hall University.
Okay.
And then he was uninvited. Now, you might think to yourself,
Okay,
you'd say,
that happens a lot lately, though.
Wait. You'd say, oh, that's an affront to his First Amendment rights.
Yeah.
But he doesn't think that. He doesn't.
I don't think it is either.
Why?
Why? Because it's a private entity.
Ah, okay. Well, you see, there's a theme here. But in a piece he wrote about that incident, he said, let me quote him, I had no right to speak at Seton Hall, but letting me speak would have been right. Roll that concept around in your brain a few times. He's saying it would have been right. They should have done it. But it wasn't my right to insist upon it, and I couldn't use the First Amendment couch it in.
Yeah, the first thing that comes to my mind, though, is what is the reason that they didn't want him to speak?
Well, I believe we do talk about that in the podcast, but I think what's most important is, John, when you get into a conversation with a gentleman like Stanley Fish, he's one of those guys who is not one of these conveniently packaged thinkers. So it's not like you say, well, he's a First Amendment advocate, therefore he must believe X, Y, and Z. Because he might agree with you on X, he'll fight you on Y, and he'll totally bulldoze you on Z. Because he's got a whole different way of looking at the First Amendment. And I think that's so important for us to understand. So the book is called The First, but here's the subtitle.
Okay, here we
How to Think About Hate Speech, Campus Speech, Religious Speech, Fake News, Post-Truth, and Donald Trump. Now, it's a really fascinating book. It really is. And I think you're going to find it a very interesting conversation, but never expect that you're going to know the twists and turns that it takes throughout the course of it.
Oh, I'm anxious to hear this.
Well, let's do it right now. On America Trends. America Trends.
With me on the line on America Trend is Stanley Fish. And let it go to the New Republic, what they said about Mr. Fish. Fish isn't only one fish. Fish, in fact, is a whole school of fish. Fish, the lawyer and dean. Fish, the columnist and the cultural critic. Fish of the right and fish of the left. Fish, the philosopher and polemicist and pundit. You are many things, Stanley Fish. And in this book, The First, you tell us that in many ways, the First Amendment is just like you. Let me read a quote from the book. A grab bag of analogies invented for the occasion of arguments, rhetorical slogans, shaky distinctions, and ad hoc exceptions to those distinctions, all combining to make it an artifact of the very politics it supposedly transcends. Well, for those who thought that the First Amendment gave us the absolute right to say anything we wanted, anytime we wanted, to anyone we wanted, you certainly do remind us that that is not the case.
No, it's not the case in several senses. First of all, the First Amendment guarantees citizens the right to speak when the government is attempting to silence them. And even that right is, of course, is not always honored. And there are many instances in which the government and the judiciary will, in fact, approve constraints on speech that originate in the state. And once you leave that area where the relationship is between the state and the individual, then your right to say what you would like to say is even more curtailed, because you're not in a situation where you have a legal justification for what you might want to say, and therefore you are vulnerable to the objections of those who have some kind of power over you, either an emotional power, as for example members of your family, or an economic power, your employer or your associates in the workplace. So that while free speech is a slogan, the thing itself is very rarely seen.
Now, your book is called The First, but it has a subtitle, and let me read that to the folks listening. How to Think About Hate Speech, Campus Speech, Religious Speech, Fake News, Post-Truth, and Donald Trump. Now, recently, as a case in point, you were invited, then disinvited, to speak at Seton Hall University. And in an op-ed that you wrote in the Wall Street Journal, you said, "I want to say as loudly as possible that there is no free speech issue here. I have no right to speak at Seton Hall, and I have not been silenced because I was disinvited." Now, this might be a good place to pave the way for us to understand the limits and contours of the First Amendment. You know that many people are arguing this is terrible, that these speakers are not invited in the first place, or then invited and disinvited. But you explain what happens in many of these cases in a totally different way than I've ever heard.
Well, yes, because I don't believe that many of these incidents, including the one that involved me, are free speech incidents. Rather, they're incidents of choices made by institutions, in this case academic institutions, to do something or not to do something. And usually the reasons for making these choices are administrative or in some broad sense political. A university doesn't want to be associated with a certain speaker, or it's felt that the presence of a speaker on campus would cause disruption, or at least the potential disruption that would involve expending large funds for security. Or there any other number of educational or institutional reasons that a university might have for saying no to a proposed speaker or to a proposed panel of speakers. But, and again to return to the example of my experience with Seton Hall, no one has the right to be invited, and no one has a legal recourse if he or she is either invited or later disinvited. Now, you might think that any of these actions performed by universities are unwise. It would have been better for them for a number of reasons not to have done that, but they have a perfect right to do that, just as Seton Hall had a perfect right not to invite me.
But you also have been a professor at many esteemed universities. If, in fact, in your classroom, under the guise of academic freedom, the First Amendment, you began teaching something and some of your students rebelled, that's not extracurricular. You are a part of the faculty, and you are then pulled up by the administration. How do you look at that issue?
Well, students are students. They're apprentices at best, and more generally, novices. They enter a world in order to be educated. Therefore, they have no right of any kind, I believe, to contribute to the structure of their own education. If I'm teaching a course, and I believe that a question raised by a student is beside the point, or perhaps belongs to the discussion of another day, or a discussion in another course, it's within my rights to say so. The student may feel he or she has been silenced, but no right of hers or no right of his has been infringed.
And let's get into that as it relates to the workplace in general, because you remind us, and it's a really important reminder, that we're dealing here in terms of speech with any rejoinder from the government, not from any private employer. And
right.
Why don't you even take us into the case of Colin Kaepernick and the issue with the NFL?
Sure. The 49ers, the NFL team, decided that it didn't want someone with Colin Kaepernick's reputation, which we might redescribe as baggage, associated with the team. Again, that is a position with which one might disagree, and you could argue it in any variety of ways, but it's not a free speech issue. It's certainly true that Colin Kaepernick engaged in political speech. But it isn't the case that political speech, whenever a citizen engages in it, is protected, because the countervailing value, which often trumps, if you'll pardon that verb, the countervailing value is the value an employer has to decide how to best order and to maintain the flourishing of the workplace. And so that free speech rights, even if they're generally held against the government, are not held against your employer, who can reasonably make a decision that someone who says the kinds of things that you say is someone that he or she doesn't want around.
Now, going back to what you said about the grab bag of analogies mm-hmm. invented for the occasion arguments, that it's certainly not something that is written in stone. And it is something that is malleable, as you say. And you also say that, in fact, to have this freedom of speech, which is a measured discourse, is the best way to really maintain that and to protect it. You say we also have to rely on censorship as a precondition to its existence. To some people who haven't been in your classroom and don't think on the synapses that you do, that's a hard concept for them to understand, or even for me. So help me to understand it.
Well, if there were free speech in the strong sense, anyone could say anything at any moment for any reason and be allowed to continue, then no organized social space could, in fact, be organized, because what you would have is a cacophony. Mm-hmm. You would have something on the order of the biblical Tower of Babel, where innumerable voices were being sent into the air, and because there were so many of them, no one of them actually registered in any way, and instead of discussion, deliberation, and argument, all you would have is noise. Those people who argue for a strong free speech position, one should be able to say anything one likes without fear of repercussions, are arguing for the central importance of noise. And I cannot myself accept that argument.
Well, to the point, let's take where we are today. And you make a strong case that without the gatekeepers that we've had, the curators, and I was a program director for a PBS station for many years, the role that I played to make sure that content was appropriate to the community and was fair and was researched appropriately and so forth. You say that today we're living in this transparent world, if you will, but it's uncurated on the internet. It is cacophonous. There is no gatekeeping. And so we think this is wonderful, but really it leads to all kinds of issues and problems that we then have to look at again. And I don't know whether that means regulation. I know you talk about Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook in your book. Give us a real good synopsis of where
you've already given, in fact, a very good synopsis, so I'll just build on what you have said. If it's the case, as transparency advocates urge, that there should be no gatekeeping or filtering, intervening between the information that is out there and our reception of it, if that were the case, then the information would just inundate us. We would be overwhelmed by us, which of course is what's happening because of internet, and any possibility of making a judgment on what was said or making good use of what was said would be greatly diminished. Gatekeepers, curators, filters are necessary in order to produce a manageable space of discussion and argument, rather than a space in which a million voices are heard to no effect except the effect of confusion. Also, when a million voices are out there and no one of them has been authorized, no one of them has been given any kind of stamp of approval, someone who wishes to pick the pieces of this unfiltered conversation up and mold them into an evil or pernicious purpose can do so, because the distrust of gatekeepers has been produced to such an extent that no one any longer today knows whom to trust. In the book, I mentioned the mid-20th century CBS anchor Walter Cronkite, who ended each day, broadcasting each day, by saying, "And that's the way it is." And most people relied on him to have at least attempted to report accurately on the way it is. And it's because of that trust that we have in certain institutions and in some cases in certain persons that we can continue in a rational way. Now, for free speech apostles, this will sound absolutely heretical and worse. But the free speech mantra, the more speech, the better, is absolutely false.
Well, we're at a point today, and I think you did such an incredible job of framing this, and I want to just allude to it right now, that fake news is created by undermining trust in traditional vehicles of authority.
That's right.
Newspapers of record, professional associations, credentialed academics, let's say scientists, you didn't say that, but government bureaus. And that puts us in a really odd space, because how do we begin to push back against falsities, many of which this fake news is made for commercial benefit of some individual, totally false, but very consumable. And of course, in this world, and many would go back to the president and what role he plays in this, the First Amendment runs up against all of this. What are we supposed to do? Grin and bear it? What do we do
when
is some level of fact and truth, but somebody's denying even the access to that?
Well, it's not that someone's denying the access so much. It's that we have, as I said a moment ago, lost our confidence in those traditional institutions and repositories of what we might call common wisdom. Once we have undermined that confidence, we're adrift in the kind of internet sea that you and I have both referred to in this conversation. So that the obvious remedy, although it's not so obvious as to how to realize it. The obvious remedy is to restore faith in those institutions. But if we are being told from a variety of persons for very different reasons that the press is the enemy of the people, that science is always in the service of some invidious and hidden commercial motive, that all university professors are political agents without advertising it, that all so-called experts are simply charlatans with loud voices. If we are being told all of this over and over again, it begins to have its effect. And therefore, you just believe whomever you want to believe. You believe the person who says the thing that you already thought in the first place. But then that raises the question, how does one restore that confidence? How does one come back to a time when not only
any
was there...
Any answers to that? Because we seem to have moved so far from that post that anyone like Walter Cronkite coming on there and saying,
right, exactly.
And that's the way it is, people would be scoffing, laughing, piling on Facebook. That's the way it is. You mean, you know, that's the way you see it. I mean, so we're so far from that North Star.
Let me answer the question with respect to one institution that used to be a repository of wisdom, or at least thought to be a repository of wisdom, and that's the university world, the academic world. Trust in the academic world has declined along with trust in newspapers and politicians and to some extent scientists. But this is that the academic world is in large part responsible for the diminishing of the respect people have for it, because what people are now saying about the academic world, that it's hostage to a political vision, that it's less the academic world is less a forum for disinterested discussion than a platform for the presentation of political views. This, unfortunately, is true on many campuses.
Mm-hmm.
And so for the university, for example, to restore the confidence of the population that it once enjoyed would mean that it would have to reform itself. And for that to happen, we'd have to have a new class of university administrators, much like the famous university administrators of the first half of the 20th century, people who were very strong in their position, stood up for academic values, didn't stand for any nonsense, and resisted all the kinds of pressures to which too many universities have yielded. Now, so that's just one answer. Now, is it likely that the university world is going to restore itself to that position by cleaning up its act? 10 years ago, I would have thought, sure, that can be done. Now I'm not so sure.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers over 40 years of experience in a broad base of services from accounting and tax to cybersecurity, technology, and transaction advisory. Bloom's experts will maintain an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
Stanley Fish is with us on America Trends. The book is called The First. Oh, just to get back to this issue of The First, there are a lot of people might think that as a guarantor of speech and, you know, the freedom to affiliate, the freedom to express ourselves religiously, that this is first because it's the most important. But help us understand why it is called the First Amendment or why it is the First Amendment.
Well, actually, historically, there's it's a series of accidents, which it's a history that I once knew something about, but in my increasingly advancing age, it's one of the things that I no longer can recall with confidence.
But it's not first among equals, necessarily.
No, but it is regarded by many, especially by, let's say, the American Civil Liberties Union and those who are admirers of the American Civil Union. First Amendment is regarded as the first among equals because it's thought that if you don't have the right to say what you think. If you live in a society where your words are continually monitored and perhaps suppressed, then the business of building a democracy, which depends on continual argument and discussion and rational deliberation, can never get started. So I think there's a good reason for the importance of the First Amendment as it is announced by the ACLU and other institutions. Where First Amendment polemics go wrong, I think, is to assume that not only is it one of the most important, if not the most important, of our democratic values, but it's a value that should be upheld no matter what the consequences of some forms of speech might be. And it seems to me that you can simultaneously affirm the importance of the free flow of speech and ideas in a democratic society and acknowledge that some ideas, some forms of speech, rather than helping to facilitate the search for truth and the search for justice, do something very much like the opposite, and that it is not in fact a violation of some kind of religious law to in some way curtail those forms of speech.
Well, let me go back to Zuckerberg. You call him a walking emblem of the tensions, paradoxes, and contradictions that emerge whenever this is an attempt to draw a clear line between what you call good, well, I'm calling, I should say, good and bad speech, that he's all over the place. And, you know, I'm not an editorial source. I'm just a technological framework that people can, you know, punch into with their ideas. What do you say about what he's saying and the impact of the Internet on what you just said about certain forms of speech being helpful to that dialogue and others not? Should there be more controls on the Internet?
Well, as you've already indicated, the question is, how are platforms like Facebook considered? Are they considered as just technical instruments that are the vehicle of message sending, but not in fact the message senders? Are they more or less the modern equivalent of what Western Union ought to be? Or are they content providers? And as content providers, there must be some concern about the value and quality of the content they provide. So Zuckerberg and some others in the high-tech world are sometimes on one side of that question, sometimes on the other side of that question, and you can understand why. Zuckerberg is the most is the best illustration because he says more things in public than most of the others. And one of the things is he says that he wants his platform to be a force for good. But on the other hand, he wants his platform not to make the kind of editorial decisions that might involve curbing the production of speech that is bad. Now, you can't have it both ways. Although you can swing back and forth as if you were a human pendulum, as the occasion calls for, as in Zuckerberg's case, depending on which committee of Congress he is testifying before at the moment. Now, the people at Twitter have decided that, in fact, they must, as content providers, take some responsibility for the content they provide. Zuckerberg has not yet reached that conclusion. But he may be forced to do so by the political pressures that we've seen in recent years.
Not to use him as a human pinata, but again in your book, to Mark Zuckerberg, and this is something everybody has heard, the argument that the more despicable the speech, the more it merits protection. And you say that there's a caveat to this. Explain what your thinking is here.
Yeah. Well, that's a very old and attractive strain in First Amendment thought. The First Amendment is really meaningful when it protects speech that we despise. But the coherence of that statement depends on the assumption that the speech that we despise will be unpleasant, or offensive, but it will not really do bad work in the world. So once you begin to acknowledge the possibility that speech is not simply a transaction between my mouth and your ear, but may in fact go out into the world and do all kinds of things, including getting people killed, including race riots, including acts of discrimination that make life unbearable for some populations. As soon as you begin to consider that, then the idea of protecting the speech that is the most despicable begins to sound like a slogan rather than a rational and realizable political idea.
Well, in the book, you try to unpack when you take the gentleman who was in Florida, I believe, and he had all kinds of stickers all over his car.
Oh, yes,
and ultimately he sent some pipe bombs around to CNN and to others, or I forgot what else he sent around. Then, of course, we've had, the person who might have given an indication that they were unhinged. And ultimately, he killed many in a synagogue in Pittsburgh. I mean, when does that line, and how bright does that line have to be when we're talking about going from speech to action? Help us to understand how that line is crossed. And, somebody driving around with all kinds of inflammatory stickers on their car, I've seen that time and again. That doesn't mean they're going to perpetrate an act.
Yes, it doesn't, although one might say, and it has been said, that they are perpetrating an act.
Mm-hmm.
So that, for example, if you have a minivan filled with slogans of hate directed at certain persons and groups, and it passes through neighborhoods, there are people who will see that.
Mm-hmm.
Or let's take a more specific instance or example of speech that is controversial, Holocaust denial, and I have a few things to say about Holocaust denial in my book.
Yes.
If you think of Holocaust denial as an argument, that is, as the proposal by some persons that the Holocaust in Europe during World War II either didn't occur or occurred in a much diminished way, that is more a way not on the scale usually reported, well, that's an argument. And you can say, well, let's hear the evidence. But on the other hand, if you begin to see Holocaust denial as an active attempt to rekindle the always ever-present embers of anti-Semitism into a roaring fire, then you might have a different notion. And in fact, just to stick with that example for a moment, there's an extraordinary uptick in anti-Semitism in this country, and even more so in some countries in Europe. And that cannot be unrelated to the kinds of slogans that might be pasted on the windows of a minivan. You yourself pointed to the concept or distinction that is being challenged by what I've been saying, and that's mm-hmm. the distinction between speech and action. A lot of First Amendment rhetoric depends on that distinction, the idea that saying something or writing something is one thing, it's a transaction of the intellect or of discussion, whereas doing something is another. And of course, when things are done, it's always the case that there could be laws regulating those things. But what I'm suggesting, and I'm not the only one, is that saying something is doing something, that the actions that are involved in producing a certain kind of speech can be as weighty and as harmful as a club that hits you on the back of the head.
We have these various manifestos that are out there, and many of them now showing up on the internet, I guess, in very dark places. And, I mean, clearly, there is some thesis that goes along before action is taken. Somebody who tries to rally groups to a cause that may be injurious to others. And it does start with them trying to convince others to join them in this, and that's speech. That's what I'm trying to, unpack, is how, we move from one to the other without using that censorship that you talked about.
Yeah, well, of course, what I've been saying, what I've been saying, and you may be resisting, I'm not sure, is that one and the other are the same.
Mm-hmm.
Speech is an action. So what we're going to talk about is whether or not to regulate the form of action called speech, although nobody would disagree that actions can and should be regulated by the state. Once we realize that speech does not exist in a special area that is cut off from the alteration of the condition of the world, then the speech-action distinction no longer seems either as firm or as comfortable to First Amendment arguments as it is usually said.
Let me go back to your book, though. You say we must clearly distinguish speech from action, and that turns out to be far from easy. Burning a flag is speech, but calling a policeman a fascist is not.
Right. Well, those are two cases. One case was Chaplinsky versus New Hampshire in 1942, where someone was convicted for calling a cop a fascist. And then there's Texas versus Johnson, which I think is 1989, where someone who burned an American flag, Mr. Johnson, whom I met recently, actually, where Mr. Johnson was acquitted because it said that his act was symbolic speech and not an act of destruction. If you have a First Amendment that can be manipulated in the way suggested by those two cases, then you have a First Amendment that does not dictate a clear line of argument, but instead, as this goes back to the beginning of our discussion, instead offers all kinds of rhetorical opportunities for one side or the other to attach themselves to it. The First Amendment, as I say often in the book, is a political prize, not something that stands apart from politics, allowing us to have rational and politics-free discussion. Whoever in an argument manages to attach the First Amendment to his or her side is likely to win. But that's a political fact, not a fact of principle. And as I say often in the book, there are no First Amendment principles.
Right. You said the doctrine of free speech is radically unstable and infinitely elastic.
Right.
So I guess the question that I think I'm leaving listeners with is, well, then what's the value of it?
Okay, that's exactly the right question. And my answer in the book is that its elasticity, the fact that the First Amendment doesn't have a hard center or perhaps any center at all, is one of its greatest recommendations. Because that's what makes it a toolkit that one can use. It's not only a ragtag bag, it's a toolkit. A toolkit that can be put to uses by you and by me. And its usefulness, in a sense, depends on its not being a hard and fixed thing. So I'm playing a double game in this book. I'm saying first that the First Amendment isn't anything, at least nothing so firm and principled as is sometimes assumed. And second, that that's not really a very bad thing. In fact, it's a good thing, because the malleability of the First Amendment makes it available for purposes that we might choose to pursue.
Well, now that we've got your mind on the line and not a lot of time, let me just give you a couple more. Citizens United versus the Federal Elections Commission, turning a free speech case into, well, money speak. Tell me what your thoughts are about that.
Well, I understand the argument. That case had two positions. The minority position, that is the dissent, argued by Justice Stevens, focused on corruption and the possibility that unlimited funds coming into the election process would mean the corruption of that process, whereas the majority was not interested in arguments of that kind. The majority asked a simple question. Is it speech? Campaign contribution speech? And if it is or can be considered to be, then it must be protected. So the majority was taking a very firm and principled view of the First Amendment, which is, I would say, is itself a political position, while the dissent was saying, no, we must look at this question in terms of the effects of allowing this money to enter the system. There's no way, by the way, to reconcile these two positions. So what we had in Citizens United is what some people called a victory for freedom of speech, and what others, and I would be among those others, called a victory for the corruption of our political election system.
Are there any counterweights left to a lie that is so large and oft repeated, said by someone who is gleaned by many to be an authority or someone who should be listened to and looked up to? In a fashion, you know, when you're looking at the people who are following that individual, who actually does have some authority, and they're just all trying to settle scores, and they feel that they've been powerless to take on various forces over the years, and so they just follow like lemmings, regardless of any fact. I mean, there's nothing in the First Amendment, I would imagine, but I mean, is there any counterweight to this propensity that we see going on in our culture?
Not if you're looking for a principle that you then invoke.
Right.
The only counterweight to lies, or to what you and I might perceive as a lie, is the attempt to persuade others to the falsity of the position. That is, you have to be able to engage in persuasive efforts. Now, what you're saying, and alas, it seems to me to be the case in many instances today, is that there are those in our society today, there have always been those, but there are those in our society today who are not open to any attempt to be persuaded, who do not really want to hear another position. And if you're asking how can people like that be reached, the answer is, not by any of us, if we're attempting to engage in discussion, maybe by an act of conversion. They wake up one morning and say to themselves, my God, what was I thinking? But although I am at times capable of persuading somebody to a point of view, I am not capable of prompting conversion. And I don't know anyone who is. Except perhaps very highly talented ministers, and neither am I one of those.
Given that the First Amendment, again, does a lot to allow these debates to go on forever and in many ways never help us to resolve them fully and continue to debate them generation after generation, what kind of caretakers have we been over the years of what was intended by the First Amendment?
Well, that is a huge question. The question exactly what was intended by the First Amendment, what was to be protected and what is not to be protected, is a more than a cottage industry in the legal world. I think that focusing on a narrow historical answer might be the most helpful. You have to ask, well, what is it that the framers were worried about? And the answer, of course, is that they were worried about living in a world where the government would criminalize criticism of itself, which is the world that many of them had escaped from. Mm. And I think, and in fact, Justice Bork in the 1971 law review essay said that that was in fact the core value of the First Amendment, and I tend to agree with him. That is to ensure that political criticism of the powers that be, would not be met with punitive legislation or judicial action. And I think, by and large, that effort has been successful. And it is the case today, as it was when the founders fashioned the First Amendment, that we, that is you and I, and citizens cannot be put in jail because we say things that are critical of the government, which of course is not true even today in many other countries in the world.
Well, if you'd like to say something critical of the government, this would be the moment, Stanley Fish. If not, we will say goodbye and thank you for this
illuminating conversation about the first, how to think about hate speech, campus speech, religious speech, fake news, post-truth, and Donald Trump. Stanley Fish, what an honor to have you with us today on America Trends.
Thank you for your excellent questions.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers 40 years of experience in industries from manufacturing to professional services to nonprofit.